Welcome to The Commentary. I'm Mark Bertrand. I'm a novelist and the pastor of Grace Presbyterian Church.
And I'm Cameron Brooks. I'm a poet and a musician. The Commentary is a weekly conversation about vision, worship, and life at Grace. And in this episode, we're going to be talking about the biblical category of enemies. I recently finished reading through the Psalms again over the summer. I usually read one psalm every day in the morning and in the evening. And so I slowly got through over the summer, and there was a period during this session through the Psalms where I was drawn to the language of enemies, evildoers, and the wicked in the Psalms. I've read the Psalms before. I've studied the Psalms.
You were drawn to it, or you just noticed it?
Both?
Yeah.
I remember putting the Bible down at night and thinking several nights in a row, interesting. Lots of enemy talk. And what I started thinking was, I, in my personal life of devotion, am more drawn to those Psalms where it seems to be a conversation between the psalmist, David, say, and God, the soul and the maker. And say Psalm 51, for example, where David's confessing his sin before the Lord, and there aren't too many overtly political implications. I mean, we know the story behind it, so we know what's going on. But the text itself seems to be between God and the writer. But then there are all these other psalms, many, I thought this time around, many that address others. And so it's not talking about Israel, but the people outside of Israel were often called the nations. Sometimes they're called evil, again, wicked or evildoers, enemies. And so I want to talk about that in this episode. And I guess I got several questions around it. One is, how do we incorporate these psalms into the life of the church? And how do we see them in light of Christ's teaching to love our enemies? So those are kind of the two big categories, but which one do you want to take first?
Well, maybe let's talk about how to incorporate them first.
Yeah.
Kind of go Old Testament, then New Testament.
Sure.
In a sense, I think there are a couple of challenges that we faced as 21st century Christians reading the Psalter, because I think noticing the thing that you're noticing is not that common. Even when we're quoting Psalms and there's some reference to, you know, like Psalm 23, being in the presence of my enemies, sometimes it's as if the language doesn't register, and what that means exactly is lost on us. And I think the reason for that is that our sense of having enemies is much less, and also complicated by the fact that we feel like we're not meant to, right? So if you ask people today, not just Christian people, but if you ask people today in the United States, you know, how many enemies do you have? A lot of people will be like, oh, I don't have enemies. It's like if you said, you know, who do you hate? A lot of people are just going to say automatically, well, I don't hate anyone. Right? Because we feel like that's the right and moral way to think about this stuff,
right?
So when I'm reading the Bible and I have a psalmist who keeps talking about people as his enemies, that's a little jarring. Like, makes me think, like, maybe I'm a little more pious than the psalmist.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I wouldn't use language like that. But then it goes farther than that, and he's wishing ill on his enemies, you know, and asking God to do bad things to his enemies. And again, that feels a little odd even to us as Christians. If next Sunday, one of our elders got up to pray and as part of his prayer started listing off all of the people that we think of as our enemies and asking God to do things to humble them and, you know, confound their plan,
yeah,
and frustrate their desires and things like that.
Yeah.
think if you were visiting the church that Sunday, you'd be a little freaked out. And honestly, even if you weren't visiting, even if you'd been there for years, you might think, what is going on here? This isn't how we talk about people. So all that to say, I think it's a legitimate problem, you know, thinking like, what do I do with this category? So one thing I think maybe as a starting point is that a lot of the reason this is difficult for us, I think, comes from the reality of our comfort and privilege, right? That we are not, for the most part, victims of terrible injustice. We have not been conspired against. We have not been, dispossessed. We have not had our inheritance taken away or our children captured or killed. And having not experienced those things, when we hear this language of enemies or this language of what sounds to us like revenge or vengeance, we tend to get on a high horse and think, well, you shouldn't think that way, right? But part of the reason is because we've never experienced those things. If we had, we might more easily put ourselves in the position of the psalmist. Mm-hmm. Right? We might understand a little bit more. So one rubric that I often recommend is whenever you encounter a psalm that's talking about something that sounds like vengeance to you, substitute the word justice and ask yourself how that fits. Because oftentimes, what's really the point of that prayer is to see justice done, right? To the one who perpetrated injustice against me and those I love, do justice to that person.
Yeah.
Vindicate your justice by bringing them to heal, something like that.
Yeah.
So it's not just like a desire for vengeance or petty revenge or something that you ought to transcend. I think it's a natural feeling towards those who have offended against you being expressed in the language of the Psalms. And I think it's the reason why there are certain Psalms that only become real or relevant to you once you've experienced things like that. And then suddenly they mean something that they didn't really mean before.
Yeah, that's helpful. Because surely if we were to go through something comparable in our own life, we would want to have a means to bring that experience before God. And I think that's what the Psalms do best, is give us language to bring our difficult experiences before God. And of course, we're just speaking in really broad brushstrokes here, but many people today are experiencing those things and probably are grateful to have these Psalms. So it's kind of, I guess, a matter of privilege for us to be able to step back and say, well, we don't experience that in the same way when probably today people still do.
I give you one example. This is probably my favorite example because if it's not the most extreme of the imprecatory Psalms, it is at least the one that boomerangs, really quickly. It's Psalm 137. So it begins, "By the waters of Babylon, there we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion. On the willows there we hung up our lyres, for there our captors required of us songs, and our tormentors mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion." And then this line, which is just incredibly beautiful and melancholy. "How shall we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget its skill. Let my tongue stick to the roof of my mouth if I do not remember you, if I do not set Jerusalem above my highest joy." When people hear that, they think, well, that's beautiful. It's been set to music. I think Simon and Garfunkel set this to music. So it tells you, something. But what doesn't get set to music is the whole thing. Because although it begins very elegiacally, "By the waters of Babylon," the final stanza, this is verse 9, "Blessed shall he be who takes your little ones and dashes them against the rock." And when you get to that, it's like, whoa, wait a second, what just happened? Is this in the Bible? Are we supposed to pray this? Is this good? And in the face of those questions, I can only say, when you've experienced the exile that they've experienced, when you've experienced the violence that's been done to them, then, and maybe only then, can you understand the cry of the heart that would long for such a thing, which for us would be unimaginable. And so I don't know, and I hope never to find out,
right,
how to pray something like this meaningfully. But I think it's only the one who suffers in that way who can really appreciate the fact that even these longings are echoed for us in the Psalms.
There was a passage in C.S. Lewis's book on the Psalms, Reflections on the Psalms, where I think he makes a distinction between a forensic approach to God, or maybe a moral forensic approach to God and prayer, which perhaps New Testament people are more accustomed to, or anyway, Protestants, when we think about our relationship to God in terms of justification and that sort of thing, as opposed to a more civil understanding. And he seems to think that many of these psalms have to do with a kind of longing for civil justice.
Yeah.
A social justice, asking God to make a situation right, which is now unjust. And perhaps it's just because of how we think in different categories that we don't understand those psalms in the same way.
Right, right. I mean, it is, you know, at its most fundamental, God is the great judge. You know, God is the holy and righteous lawgiver and the judge of us all. And crying out to the judge to do justice, crying out to the judge to say, how can you permit this evil to take place? How can you let it go unpunished? We all do that in our everyday lives, right? We're all outraged when we see injustice go unpunished. This is the same kind of thing. It's just that sometimes the scale of the injustice to those who experience it is greater than we can appreciate until we have experienced something like that. And then suddenly it clicks.
Yeah.
I think another thing too that we have to think about though is that question of whether it's okay to have enemies, because that's another, you know, difficulty we have. So Jesus says we have to love our enemies. The Psalms are in the Old Testament. So it's kind of easy to tell ourselves something like, okay, well, it was fine then to have feelings like this and to use the E word, but we shouldn't do that. Now that Jesus has told us that this stuff is bad, we should now no longer think of other people as our enemies, which I think is a very pious, but not very realistic way of approaching things, right? It comes from, as we say these days, a place of privilege that really doesn't stand up to reality, right? You may tell yourself, well, I don't have any enemies. Nobody wishes me ill, but if so, great. I mean, you've lived a charmed life, but not everybody has that. And there are a lot of people who know what it's like to be targeted by others, who know what it's like to have real enemies, real people plotting against them. And yeah, this is dealing with that reality in the Psalms as well. So, Jesus says, love your enemies, but in order to love your enemies, you have to sometimes recognize that they exist.
Right. Yeah. I had a professor in seminary who believed that command of Jesus essentially did away with the whole category of enemies. And that's what Jesus was trying to do, was trying to help his disciples see, look, you should look out at the world and only see friends. There are no enemies. But I remember one student raised his hand and essentially said what you just said, which is, well, then how do you love your enemies?
Right.
If you don't know who they are.
Yeah.
And
you love them out of existence.
Yeah.
Sounds really bad.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds very progressive.
Yeah.
Maybe too progressive, but
yeah.
But I think you're right though, that the category still exists for us, but the call to love them is,
yeah,
just as real.
I think, yeah. I mean, there is something about your professor's stance that I admire, right? And I think there's a truth there that the trajectory of loving your enemies is reconciliation. If not from their side, at least from yours, right? And that has limits though, right? So loving your enemies doesn't mean continuing to enable their abusiveness, right? So we wouldn't say, yeah, you're in an abusive relationship, but you just need to, you know, allow this evil to continue and call that loving your enemy, because, you know, it's not loving to let people put a divine target on their backs, right? To continue in their evil ways. So it's more complicated than that, right? So I think in one sense, we have to recognize the reality of that category of enemy, of evildoer, let's say. But then our orientation towards them is one of love. You know, not naivete, not denial, but still love. And so that does change one aspect of the relationship. It doesn't eliminate the category of enemy, I think, but it changes how enemies are treated. So retribution is off the table, right? You may restrain evil, but you don't get to fight evil with evil. It does transform the way that we see, like what our hopes are for our enemies, let's say. So I think the longing for justice does not go away. But it does seem to me that in the gospel, there is now an awakening of a longing for reconciliation between God and the enemy that would reconcile us to our enemies as well. And I think that is something that we can see as like a new aspect that the gospel brings, right? Because from the standpoint of the psalmist, with that division between Israel and the nations, the idea of praying to God to be reconciled to the Edomites, for example, or the Egyptians or whatever, would have seemed contrary to God's plan, his plan of salvation, which at that point had been revealed as an ethnic plan. But of course, in the New Testament, a great mystery is revealed of Gentile inclusion. And so that attitude towards the nations would change. And so I think at least that is captured, like the command to love our enemies, if we practiced it, would change that perception. But I would say people who go around in denial, trying to convince themselves they have no enemies, aren't really loving their enemies. If anything, we're eliding the fact that there are people that we have a responsibility to love despite their actions, right? And so for us, being able to name the enemy, even if it's just like, I don't want to see you as my enemy, but I recognize that you have set your sights on me.
Yeah.
By being able to say that, it allows me to acknowledge that I still have to love you. And I don't get to respond in kind, right? And so again, the naming is not bad. And I would say the naming is necessary in some sense so that we can actually practice the love that we've been called to.
That's helpful. I've got one more question though. As I was reading those Psalms, I remember thinking, this feels a little bit moralistic. The evil people are out there. The wicked are out there. God, do something about them.
Yeah.
Because of my righteousness sometimes, or just because I'm praying to you, I'm an Israelite, whatever it is. And that to me seems also discontinuous with the New Testament picture, which is, yes, the church, inclusive of Gentiles, is a holy nation, a people set apart for God's purposes, and unique in that respect. And yet it's not like the church sits back and looks at the world with contempt, but with love because of what Christ calls us to. So I'm trying to figure out, how do we incorporate these Psalms, which are prayers, into the life of the church? How do we pray them while maintaining a culture of grace to outsiders?
No, I mean, it's a great question. So not long ago, we sang in our worship service Psalm 125 as a psalm refrain, which you wrote the music to. Right, so over and over again, we are singing, as the mountains surround Jerusalem, so the Lord surrounds his people from this time forth and forevermore. Right, so this beautiful image of his people protected by him, the way Jerusalem is by the mountains. But there is a line in that psalm that every time we do this, in my mind, I imagine, like, do we need to put an asterisk in there? You know, sometimes when a church will do the Apostles' Creed, for example, they'll have like a little asterisk next to the word Catholic,
right,
to explain, not that kind of, not Roman Catholic, but small c Catholic in the sense of the ancient church's usage. And this line is verse 4. It says, "Do good, O Lord, to those who are good and to those who are upright in their hearts. But those who turn aside to their crooked ways, the Lord will lead away with evildoers." And it's exactly what you're talking about, right? Where, I mean, it to us, our New Testament ears, sounds so moralistic. Do good, Lord, to the good people, and do bad to the bad people. And of course, we're the good people,
right?
The bad people are the ones out there. So I do not like to go back and retcon this stuff, right? And qualify it. I think sometimes you have to sit with these statements and not always make those adjustments. So there is a theological adjustment, right, that we can make. So no, we're not saved by our own righteousness. We're saved by Christ's righteousness imputed to us. But Christ's righteousness is him doing good, right? And so when I hear those words, "Do good, O Lord, to those who are good," I can almost say to myself, "Do good, O Lord, to him who is good,"
right,
and to all those who are in him, and make that adjustment that, mm-hmm. that kind of fits with that progressive revelation. But I don't have to then ignore that the Bible is full of language talking about rewards for righteousness and punishments for unrighteousness. And that's what this is referencing, right? So even though I know none of us does good in a way that deserves good, I understand that this is a legitimate way of speaking. You know, reward righteousness, great judge of all things, and punish iniquity, great judge. Like, this is what we should all long for. And so I think there's a way to understand these things, but it's better for us to let those tensions stand and have to think about them than to qualify them too quickly.
Right.
So that, you know, we're doing that thing that I mean, I grew up with this, but you'd read a verse and almost immediately be told, "Well, I know it says this, but what it means is this." And it's like, yeah, I get that. Sometimes, you know, definitely it's important to emphasize the actual meaning of the words. But sometimes what we're doing is just kind of eliding the obvious meaning and substituting something else. So I'm saying let's have both, right? Let's let these words of the psalmist stand, create a problem for us, and then have to think about that problem so that we understand what it is Christ has done for us, rather than when we hear this, just dismiss it as mere moralism and all that. And in doing so, it kind of helps us maybe understand a little bit about moralism, right? And why it's so deeply ingrained in human nature that you know, even people who don't believe in good and evil think they're good people, and that evil people should be punished. You know, it's the reality of being human. And so, again, I think that, as in so many things, the challenges that Scripture presents to us are its greatest learning opportunities. Right? They force us to think about these questions, and it's one of the reasons why, having incorporated the Psalms in our worship for so long, and being confronted by things like this, that actually has helped us, you know, to kind of have this redemptive historical understanding.
Yeah, I agree completely. And I particularly love the way that we sing the Psalms, which is not in your standard Psalter way exactly, where you Psalm 90, you just sing right. The whole thing. But we pick out a refrain and we set that to music, which becomes an anchor,
right,
for the text, and then the text itself is read, and we come back to the refrain again and again, and so that orients our hearts in the right way, but allows us still to hear the text as text,
right,
and to wrestle with it over time.
And honestly, if you had come to me and said, hey, I've made a psalm refrain, we're going to sing over and over again, do good, O Lord, to those who are good, I'd say, and maybe that's not what we should sing over,
yeah,
and over,
yeah,
again, you know? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we do make choices like that about what to emphasize, but yeah, I mean, there's a, I think the beauty of psalmody in the church is that not only, you know, does the Psalter give us this kind of wide-ranging sense of human psychology, human longing, and you know, like human longing before God specifically, but it also challenges us, because the reality is our experience is less full than what is reflected in the Psalms. And oftentimes the things we struggle with are indicators of where we have maybe experienced less of what it means to be human, right, than others have. And so, like I say, I mean, I don't, you know, want to be targeted by a cabal of enemies so that I can better understand the Psalms, but I can appreciate through the Psalms what those longings are, what they look like. And sometimes, honestly, it helps me to sympathize with those who really have that experience and can pray those things without any difficulty.
Yeah. Well, I'm not giving up on the Psalms, don't worry. I've started through my read again. I think I'm on Psalm 3, and we'll see what catches my attention next time.
Yeah, and if you want to make a psalm refrain of Psalm 137, just go right ahead.
All right.